Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast channeling to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to writer-director John Berardo about his latest feature, the feminist slasher Initiation. In the interview, I talked to John about how he wanted to make a horror film exploring the toxic party culture of many a college campus, how the feature stemmed out of his 2013 short film, Dem Banger, and how he collaborated with lead actress Lindsay Lavanshi on the script and petitioned for her to be in the lead role for the feature as she was the lead actress in the original short film. Elsewhere in the interview, we talk about his main slasher inspirations, how the film has quite a 90s feel to it, and his interest in making genre films with a strong LGBTQ identity to them. Also, if while listening to the interview, you are a little confused by some of the references we make within the interview, it was recorded at the end of 2020, so that makes a whole lot more sense for you, I'm sure. Anyway, now on to the interview with John. Hi, John. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hi, Scott. Thank you so much for having me to discuss horror.
That's no problem. No problem at all. So we have you on the show today to talk about your new film, The Slasher Initiation. Or in it, exclamation mark, Asian. Give us a brief spoiler-free synopsis of your film, Initiation.
Well, Initiation is a movie about a girl who's at a college called Whitney University, and she is a sorority girl. She's the president of her sorority, Kappa Kappa Tau. And the night of homecoming, one of her sorority sisters tells her that something happened to her at one of the homecoming parties at her fraternity. And the following days after, a star athlete who's part of that fraternity is murdered. And students on campus continue to be targeted and murdered. And this whole conspiracy unravels involving the university and, you know, things that the university's hiding and this online game that these college students play involving an exclamation point and tagging girls that they hook up with. And it all comes to a head at the end when you find out that that not everybody's who they appear to be.
And where did the initial idea for the feature film come about?
That's a super long story, and I'll try to sum it up fast. I was in grad school at USC, and I took a class called Making Media for Social Change. And the goal of the class was to make a short film that basically was about a social issue that we would then show the film to a test audience, and we would get their reaction to that issue. And I wanted to make, I grew up on 90s slasher films. Scream is my Bible. And Scream, I know you did last summer, Urban Legend. Those horror movies came out when I was at the age of watching them and totally obsessed with them all, like obsessed. My dad used to say that if Neve Campbell came in my room, she'd call the police because I had so many photos of her on my wall. And so I knew I wanted to make a Scream-like horror movie, and I wanted to do it differently than we had seen before. And one of the first things I wanted to do was a sort of a gender swap. And I wanted to make a horror movie to where we didn't see women as victims or helpless victims, but we saw men as helpless victims, and we sort of swapped those roles. But you know, that's more of a eye candy sort of change. Really, the whole point of the social issue that I went on was Facebook. This was in 2012, and I basically wanted to make the first scene a Scream about a guy who posts too much about himself online and somebody who he doesn't know follows him and ends up finding out where he is and murders him. You can watch the movie on online. It's called Dembanger. And the movie did really well as a short. It specifically with test audiences, like 90% of the audience that watched my film went on Facebook and changed their privacy settings after watching Dembanger. So I knew that I had something there. But then the movie Unfriended came out, and you saw this rise of horror about privacy and online privacy. And I knew that there was still a way to keep that, but make an even better story. And I'm from Norman, Oklahoma, and I'm sure in Scotland, you guys have no clue what that is, but Oklahoma, I mean, do you know Oklahoma, where Oklahoma is in the United States?
It's kind of Midwest, right?
Yeah, yeah. Damn, great job. It's on top of Texas. It's like the Midwest and the South. And Norman, where I'm from, is the hometown of the University of Oklahoma. So I grew up in a college town, and both my parents worked for the university, and just college life was embedded in my life growing up. We went to football games every Saturday, and I'm talking, you know, the entire town would be at the stadium, and I would be on campus every day almost. And so doing that, you really grow up around the culture of college. And you hear all the stories of your friends who graduate high school and go to OU, and you know that things happen to them at parties, and people just didn't talk about it. People didn't talk about the sorts of sexual assault was what it was. It is raping that was going on at these parties. And leaving Oklahoma and coming to Los Angeles, I went to UCLA, and it was worse. And then I graduated at UCLA and went to USC, and at USC it was worse. And there's just a culture that I couldn't turn away from when it came to wanting to make a movie about college. So I decided to take this idea of online privacy and embed it into a world that I thought that I knew well, and I knew that I could turn into a really well-structured horror film with characters that audience members could identify with. Wrote a script. It took me years to really get the script to the right place and get the movie financed. And I co-wrote it with one of my buddies who I went to USC with, Brian Frager, who also produced the movie. And he and I own the production company that produced it, Shatterproof Films. We started it when we graduated together. And we co-wrote it along with the lead actress, Lindsay Levanche, who plays Ellery Scott. She's an actress that I actually went to UCLA with. And when I was at UCLA, I studied theater directing, and I would cast her in everything because she's just fucking great. I've never, ever worked with such a committed actress. And I just knew from the beginning I wanted to cast her as Ellery. And she would come over and read my script and give me ideas. And I was like, you know what? You're a great writer. You want to write this with us? And she came on and started co-writing the script with us. And about 2.5 years later, we ended up getting financed. And before you know it, we were in production for the movie.
I was wondering on that, you know, I was wondering, there's the three of you writing the script. What was the process there? What was the writing process? Were you all in a room together, kind of jointly writing the script? Did you have bits that you wrote yourself and came to each other and was like, this is a scene? Or what was the process like?
Very unconventional. And it was a process, like anybody who wants to make movies with their friends, it's hard. It's hard to you know, Brian, especially as you get older and you grow up, you know, you have friends that go this direction in the business and friends that go that direction in the business. And so at the beginning, Brian and I wrote the first draft of the script, which is nothing like the movie, you know, beyond like a group of friends and somebody, you know, murdering them. I wrote the first draft in my final semester at USC. And then Brian and I had talked about writing it together for a while. And he and I wrote a couple drafts together. And it really was hard for us to get anybody to take a look at it. And so I ended up joining a management team that said to me, we want you to write this alone. We don't want you to write it with anybody. And so I talked with Brian about it, and you know, he was like, look, man, like, let's just get this movie made. So I started working on it solo, and that really did not work out. I think partly just because the, you know, the management team, I'm no longer with them. You know, it really, it was one of those moments where you have like one shot in this business. It's like, you're like, okay, this is your shot. And I didn't get the ball in the hoop that first shot when I wrote the script on my own. So, you know, after about, you know, and at the same time I was freelancing as a director, I was working on a lot of, you know, totally different projects, but still making my life such that I, John, could focus on this script. And Lindsay came on. It was just me writing it, and Brian was still going to get a co-writer credit because he had written quite a few of the drafts, so that, you know, was still very heavily part of the story up until then. And then Lindsay came on, and then she and I would meet, the two of us, regularly. And then towards the end of the process, Brian and I and Lindsay, all three of us, would meet on the last few drafts together. And it was sort of like we all started separately and then came in, you know, back and forth over the years. And then in the final year, we all worked on it together. It's a crazy process. And it's one that I would definitely do differently if I had another round at it again, just because, you know, there's so many factors that go into co-writing. And when I say factors that go into co-writing, I mean, it's like not everybody has the same schedule. In Los Angeles, you know, if you're a starving artist, you've got to have a job. Brian, he got married and he's starting a family. And so it's like, you just have to find time to make make the movie writing process work with all of those factors. And, you know, we were able to do it, and that's how we did it.
I was wondering as well, given some of the parallels, I know that you were talking about that the script was inspired by some of the things you saw firsthand at various university campuses, that kind of toxic environment. But I was wondering if the script was in any way influenced by the Brock Turner case, just because the swimming thing, and, you know, like, I know it's very different circumstances of how the assault is. But if that had impacted at all.
I mean, it absolutely impacted the movie in terms of the fact that people were talking about it. And especially, it was a case that obviously you heard around all around the world.
Yeah.
But the truth of it is we actually did not steer the script towards that case. We changed it up until probably the last two drafts of the script, Wes was a football player. And when it came down to going into production, there was no way I felt we were going to be able to really show what it was like to be at that sort of, you know, to be at a Division IV football team. I think it's Division IV sports. Analogies aren't great. But, you know, to be at like an OU or a USC or UCLA, you'd need a shit ton of money to film those scenes and to make it realistic. And we didn't have the money to do that. And I knew that going into production, as we were getting our financiers, I just knew that if I wanted to make it realistic and I wanted to, you know, put the actors in a world that was real, football wasn't going to be attainable. So we changed it to swimming. And obviously that Brock Turner case said, you know, I thought that, oh, that's perfect. I mean, it was really more, it just kind of fell into place that way. But you know, it is interesting, you know, now looking back at it, how I'm sure many people think that that was a huge inspiration behind it. But the truth of it is that we just really wanted to make the movie about an athlete. It didn't really matter what the sport was.
Yeah. And I think obviously the only reason that people will, like me, will make that connection is one, that's one of the kind of internationally known cases that made all the way over here in Scotland and all over the world. And also just the swimming thing, you know, the central the character gets murdered, as you pointed out, swimmer. Yeah. And obviously Brock Turner was a swimmer who had Olympic aspirations, and that was the only kind of real connection. You know, the kind of circumstances of everything else is obviously very different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think that especially here in the States, if a university is going to pay for you to swim at their school, they've got the Olympic gold in mind. You know, they're not just going to ask you, you know, they're not going to ask you to come swim, you know, to win a couple competitions. Like, they want to be on the national platform. And, you know, that's, it's the same with, you know, a huge football school.
Yeah, obviously they're, yeah, the angling for the kind of NFL connection.
Exactly. It's, you see how these universities, you know, it's, college has definitely changed and it's going to continue to change. And the point of college for students who go there, or to any, go to any school. And it's all about money, all about money.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as somebody who, we'll get back to your movie in just a sec, but yeah, as somebody who's kind of interested in sports, you know, it's very, the system that you go over there is very curious, and I know that there's obviously been a lot of complaints over the years about the way that universities don't really take care of their players, and just about cashing in on that connection with the NFL and the major leagues and the other sports as well.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's and you obviously the huge case is last year is the Rick Singer, you know, kids pay for play kind of vibe. You know, they pay their way into a university to get into it. And USC and UCLA and Stanford, I mean, you're an idiot to not think that any student that goes to one of those schools, you know, that either the student, you know, obviously everybody works hard to, you know, everybody who does work hard to get into those schools deserves it. But there are so many students at these universities who get in because of who they are and how much money their parents have. And that sort of spirit, that environment is just rampant at every university. It's all about clout. And, you know, if you're able to pay for a school like USC, especially at the undergrad level, you know, it's not a small price tag. So if your parents have a lot of money and you want to go to a school that's known for partying or known for swimming or whatever it is that you want to do, like your parents are going to be able to get you in.
So kind of steering back towards the film, was it always the intention to have Lindsay be the lead actress in the film as the character of Ellery? Was that always her character, did you think?
Yeah, it really was. I'd say in earlier drafts of the movie, we had a different character. Like, I'm talking like 2012 drafts. You know, there was a different character. But, you know, Lindsay's an actress. I'm the kind of, first and foremost, I'm a director over a writer. And so if I'm going to write something, I have to have an actor in my brain who I know is capable of playing that role as I write it, even whether I cast that actor or not. And that's something that, you know, I had a teacher in film school teach us. And Lindsay was an actress that I worked with. The first thing I ever directed her in was A Streetcar Named Desire. She played Blanche DuBois. And then she was in my thesis at USC, a play called After the Fall with Arthur Miller. And she's just a force, and she's a movie star. And I knew that the day I laid eyes on her and watched her. And she and I started working together when we were very young, and we just had one of those cosmic connections, and the stuff that we made was good. You know, we made good work together. You have those people in life that you work with. And so any script I work on, I have a role that I know Lindsay's capable of playing, I will place her in that in my mind. And she knew, sorry, I've got dogs here. I'll be, chill out. Okay. She knew that that the script was being written. She'd come read it with me. And it was, you know, it was just something that I always knew. And that was a hurdle to get the movie sold. I'm not going to lie to you. That was, and she knew that. It's very difficult to go to an investor and say, hey, I've got this cool movie, but the lead's already cast. You can't do that. That was the main reason it was, you know, that we got so many no's at the beginning. And of course I wouldn't, you know, go into these meetings and be like, well, I've already got the lead cast, but the minute that somebody would sense that the lead role was already, that the director wanted to cast this actress who, you know, Lindsay, her credits weren't huge. She was on some MTV shows, or she was on Scream, and she was, you know, she was on a couple of other shows as some guest appearances, but she hadn't had a recurring role yet. And so, you know, of course, actors that are in her position, they need people to see what they're good at, you know, to see what they're good at and give them an opportunity and a shot. And that was a hurdle that I fought. And luckily our investor, the minute I met our first, you know, the investor that we ended up really getting this movie into production. And the minute I met him, I knew that I needed to introduce him to Lindsay first. And that was a smart choice, because the minute he met Lindsay, he knew right away, you know, that she would be a great Ellery, and the rest is history.
And in terms of the rest of the cast, was there other people that you kind of had in mind, or that you deliberately reached out to, or was it mainly just additions?
It was definitely, I would say, yeah, people that I had in mind. Another actor was my brother, James Berardo. He plays the role Dylan, and Dylan was definitely written for James. My brother, he's 5 years younger than I am, and he came out to LA the year that I graduated UCLA, and he sort of got to watch me start film school in grad school, and I think he thought, you know, and he loves comedy and he loves to do improv. And so I wanted to write a role that I knew that he could really shine in. Froy Gutierrez, he was somebody that I knew before. And I actually had already had somebody in mind for Wes. I was pitching somebody else as Wes, but as the script, you know, developed and you know, the character developed, I just knew that Froy would be the perfect casting for Wes, because you know, Wes was a character that we couldn't have an audience look at him and say, oh, that guy, he's a bad guy, or that guy, he's a good guy. We needed somebody who was in the middle, that you just didn't know what he was up to. And Froy, he was on Teen Wolf, and, you know, he blew up online after that appearance on Teen Wolf. And I knew that he had a vulnerability to him, still being so young, because the age gap between, you know, a lot of the actors is pretty large. Some of them are much older than the others. And so I felt like that age gap actually worked in our advantage. And so, you know, he said yes, and he actually recommended Isabella Gomez for Kylie. Mm-hmm. And so I called her and I sent her the script, and she immediately responded and said that she'd love to do it. And let's see, the Maxwell Hamilton, who plays Tyler, the lab scientist, our sort of, you know, crazy character, he played Wes in the short. And actually Lindsay was in the short as well. So Maxwell Hamilton and Lindsay, they were in the short together. And Max also went to UCLA with us, and I had cast him in a couple of plays that I directed and continued to cast them in films that I made at USC. And so I knew that I wanted, again, to write a role for Max that he could really excel in. And that experience is just, as a director, like, the most beautiful thing you can do is see an actor that you've watched for 10 years grow, and then be able to create a role for them and see them just take that role and take it, you know, to the bank. It's really cool. But the rest of the cast, we had an amazing casting director. Her name is Ricky Maisler, and she's actually from Oklahoma. And I think that that was one of the reasons she took a chance on us, was the Okie ties that she had with me. And she brought John Huertas, she brought Lachlan Monroe, she brought Bart Johnson, Patrick Walker. I mean, she really colored this cast. And that's one of the things that I just will forever just be so grateful for, is this movie, to be able to get to the audience that I know that is right for it, needs to have a cast like we have. I mean, Kent Falcon, I mean, like, all of us, all of them are great. And Yancey Butler, she was also one that was brought in by Ricky. It is crazy too how big this cast is. I remember Brian saying to me during production, like, holy shit, our cast is huge. and it's not something that you really think about, but, you know, if you're going to write a horror movie and you need all these suspects, you need to have a big cast, you know, otherwise it's not, the mysteries, it's going to be easier for the audience to catch up to.
That is true. You need a couple of red herrings in there.
Yeah. And actually the, The other really interesting casting story is that the character Shailene, Shireen Lai, she, and you know, I hope she doesn't kill me for saying this, I don't think she would, but you know, she's one of the younger ones, and she actually had never performed before in her life. And I met her, and I just basically knew that if I was going to get this investment, I had to cast her. And or at least I didn't have to cast her, but I need to give her a chance. I needed to, because she, you know, was connected with our investors. And, you know, they would say like, you don't have to cast her, but, you know, we'd like to see what she can do. And she killed it. And she became best friends with Lindsay and Isabella. And they're like, just this like, you know, trio of Charlie's Angels, just, you know, going and getting dinner together now and having time of their lives together. And it just worked out perfectly. It really did.
You mentioned there some of the kind of known names in the cast, people like Scary Movies, Lachlan Monroe, Hard Targets, Yancey Butler, and Castles, Yon Werthers. Were you at all, being a kind of, this being your feature film debut and them being kind of known names, were you at all nervous directing them? And were you at all nervous that they would be kind of big shot you?
Not at all. No, I felt like they were more nervous around me because my energy is super intense. No, I'm excited. I was on cloud nine. I was living a dream, man. I still am. I was not nervous in the least bit. I was just excited to play with them and create this world together. And I think that when you come on a set as a director with that sort of vibe and energy, the actors instantly loosen up. They instantly have a good time, and the crew senses that, and everybody's able to do the best job that they are there to do. And so as a director showing fear, I mean, I didn't have any fear. The only fear that I had was like, I actually had no fear during production. I knew that our producers were the ones that were carrying the burden of fear and what needed to happen, you know, more on like a logistical production standpoint of like, oh shit, we lost this location, we got to get this location last minute. But I didn't know any of that on set. You know, like I was really put in an environment to where I didn't have to be afraid. And I also was just, I'm a very meticulous director with my shots and working with my DP, John Pope, who actually, he did the short as well, Dembanger. He went to USC with us. So as a director, I would come to set, I drew every shot out. I storyboarded every single shot. And then I had it in my loft. I have a cyclorama where we do photo shoots, and I just taped them all up to that cyclorama. I'm talking like, you know, almost 500 shots. And I think when you show up to set as a director with that, I would have a giant board with all these pictures on it, and the actors can see, oh, okay, that's me. Oh, okay, that's the kind of, the shots weren't exact. You know, it's like, it's just a starting place. And I think when you show up to set, even just with those pictures, for the actors to see that this is what they're gonna be in, it gets them excited. But in turn, it just, because I knew what I wanted and I had been working on this movie for so many years, I didn't have that fear of like, am I getting everything I need? I knew what I needed to get. Not only, I trusted my DP to get the shot because we worked on it together. And I just, you know, focused on making sure that we could get the performance for that shot, because we literally had like maybe 2 to 4 takes per shot based on our schedule. We had a very condensed schedule. We shot this movie in like 16 days. And so I knew that I just had to be confident. You know, whether I was confident in a certain scenario or not, I needed to make sure and project that so the actors could deliver.
And what was the atmosphere like on set?
Oh my gosh, it was wonderful. It was, I think every single crew member and cast member would come back and do it again. That's something that I feel I want to hear after I make a movie. I want everybody to hit me up afterwards asking to do it again. We were a huge family. We spent the first half at this house. We're pretty much essentially a 3-week production. And we spent the first half at this house, and then the first week. And then the second week, you know, we're at UCLA and then USC. And then the final location where we did majority of our scenes was this old construction, half-built postal service campus that we made look like it was a college campus, but it was actually a campus and an abandoned campus that the post office used to own in Pomona, California, which is just right inside the LA city limits. And so it's like, you know, it's anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour away from central LA. So we had an Airbnb out there. And so of course, when you're living together for 3 weeks and you're sleeping in the same, you know, Airbnb house and going to set together, you just establish this family. And then of course you're doing night shoots. Like half our production was 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And the night shoots, you know, we're all different creatures when the moon comes out versus the sun. We all act differently at night. And it just sort of brings out the spirit of the movie. And it was just, it was a dream. It was the most wonderful experience. The worst thing that happened on set wasn't even our doing. It was the beginning of our third week. Our costume director, Jess, she was leaving set and she got hit by a drunk driver in her car. Luckily, it was scary. It was like one of those moments where we were like, holy shit, what just happened? Like, it was like, I remember hearing it as I was saying goodbye to her. Luckily, she was okay. And luckily we had an amazing, she was okay. Luckily she did her job so well that, you know, we had an amazing team of PAs and assistants that came to help her and execute the rest of the film. The film wasn't affected by it whatsoever. We had an amazing producer team that just went in there and took care of it. And luckily she was okay. Her car got totaled, but she was fine. And, she's living her best life in Hawaii on a show right now. And, I definitely am bummed that she wasn't there because really the final week was like the fun murder. I mean, we already got a lot of murder scenes, but, you know, it was like the big ones. And I was kind of bummed that she wasn't there to be there for all of that. She came back a couple of times. She definitely had a small neck injury, I believe, but we were just all so happy that she was okay. And that we were all able to move forward and keep the spirits high. But yeah, it was a great experience. I wish it was longer. I can't wait for the day that I have twice as much money to have twice as long of a shoot, you know, and have that experience.
That sounds like it was a pretty smooth shoot then, particularly for like a kind of debut feature. It seems like it went well.
It did. It went really well. And I wouldn't have been able to live with myself if I knew that it didn't go well after the fact. So I needed to make sure it went well. You know, I wasn't about to, you know, I mean, this is what I would say to my parents, like making this movie was my dream. You know, I wanted to make this movie. It's like, that was my only purpose in life. And, whenever you're stepping up to the plate there, you got to make sure that you do it right.
I was also thinking like, while watching the movie, it's an interesting movie in terms of the kind of, it seems like it is made by a fan of slashers. It seems to encompass many, obviously it's modern and today because of the visualization of social media and the particular social issues it's kind of touching on, but it also feels very much like a 90s slasher, which is not surprising given what you said earlier, but there's also little bits of kind of 80s slasher in there as well. I noticed a couple of music stings that were very similar to Friday the 13th and Halloween. And of course you cast Deborah DeLisle in a cameo role who slasher fans will know as the girl who comes out the fridge in Slumber Party Massacre.
Oh, I'm so proud of you for catching that. Yes. Yeah. Yes to all of that. I felt like, horror is that genre, and you're going to see this. It's a genre to where as it develops, because it's a new genre, you know, there's so many documentaries online that you can watch about the evolution of horror films. But, you know, in terms of cinema, it's a genre that, you know, hasn't always been viewed as like, is a career, you know, career builder genre, you know, back in the 80s. I just remember watching this documentary about Michael Myers and how Halloween just changed the genre forever. And so then in the 80s, all of these like quickly made, you know, slasher movies were coming out. That definitely, I wanted to have a bit of that spirit in there. I'd say intentionally, definitely the Deborah casting. Deborah, who's just the most wonderful woman, she is, believe it or not, she and I met on a set for a commercial for a hospice care where I cast her as a nurse. And she's, we're just talking and she's asking me about what movies I'm making. And I was telling her about, you know, originally it was called Dembanger, but Initiation. And she was like, I was in Slumber Party Massacre. And I was like, shut the fuck up. Who are you? And then I instantly opened up IMDb and I was like, I cannot believe I'm like standing here with a scream queen. And I just cast her as a hospice nurse. Like, I need to put her in my film. And so she, like, you know, I knew right away that I was going to give her something in it. And because if you watch, you know, the movies, especially from the 90s, they do that. They have little, you know, you got Henry Winkler and Scream. They use the same names as characters from previous slasher films, like in Scream at the beginning, the father of Drew Barrymore says, go to the McKenzies. That's a line from Halloween. And so I wanted to do that. I wanted to keep that. You know, you stop seeing that in horror movies, you know, once the 2000s came and all the remakes and the Japanese remakes started coming out. And so I felt like I wanted to definitely do that with, you know, with the casting and the characters' names, like Westcott, that rhymes with Prescott, Sidney Prescott, which, you know, not many catch that. But also with the weapon, the killer's weapon being a drill is definitely an homage to Slumber Party Massacre, which is, some people call a feminist horror film because it was written and directed by a female. And apparently the original script was very different. And then, you know, the producing team came in and just totally changed it to this Pulp Fiction 80s slasher that we love so much. And so the drill is a weapon that I believe, you know, obviously it's phallic, you know, I'm not going to beat around the bush on that. It's a very phallic weapon. I mean, every slasher movie is a phallic weapon, with a giant knife, you know, man with a knife chasing a screaming girl. And so the drill was something I wanted to revive. And that was actually, you know, that changed because at first the killer would only use a drill, but then as the script developed, you know, we kind of realized that we needed to incorporate some other weapons to make the drill realistic. You know, you're not gonna be able to just go up to somebody and start killing them with a power drill. You know, you'd have to like maybe wound them and then use the power drill for something else.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, that sort of evolved the weapon and the mask, the killer's mask was very important to me. I really wanted it to have, you know, the spirit of the Scream mask, not with how it looked, but what it meant. The Scream ghost face, I remember reading when I was like 11 years old, some review, I think it was maybe Roger Ebert, when Scream came out. And one of the things I read was that the mask, Wes Craven had gone through so many iterations of the mask, and ultimately they came on this Halloween store mask that they found because it was essentially the character looking at themselves when they saw the killer because they were screaming. And it was scary. It's like you'd see this figure trying to kill you and you scream and you're seeing yourself stare back at you. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was so brilliant. And that just stuck with me, you know, for the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so when I made the initiation mask originally, I was like, well, let's just have a reflective mask so people can actually see themselves. And we, you know, we actually just had this, I'm not sure if you saw the movie Urban Legend 2 Final Cut, but the mask kind of looked like that, but it was reflective.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I just hadn't thought of that. It's a long time since I've seen that. Yeah, when I was it actually reminded me a little bit of the original kind of Halloween mask. When I was watching the movie and taking some notes, I wrote down EDM Michael Myers.
Yes, exactly. And I wanted that EDM. Like, we had a line in the script that got cut out where, you know, they talk about the mask, because that's another thing is I wanted the mask to be part of the world, not just like, oh, this guy finds a mask and wears it. You know, I wanted the audience to see how the mask originated. And yeah, it was definitely a party mask. Yeah, an EDM, you know, Electric Daisy, Coachella type of mask that, you know, you would see at a festival like that, which of course a fraternity party college kid would have. And yeah, so
that makes sense.
That on top of it being reflective. And so we had just this like one kind of like just this one plate, it was rounded plate over the killer. And we actually shot a couple promos that we would use to pitch with that mask. And I remember the DP said to me when we were location scouting, pretty close to production, actually. He's like, you know, honestly, like, I think the mask could be cooler, you know, like a little more geometric. And I'm like, oh, that's a really great idea. And so I basically cut up that, you know, the one mask that we had, just, you know, this piece of plastic, I cut it up and then just started piecing it together to see how I could make it look like this geometric mirror with angles to it. And Brian Frager, the co-writer producer, his uncle is a retired Disney Imagineer, and you know, he loves making this shit. And so he, you know, he came on board right away and started designing it, you know, based on that crummy cut up Halloween mask I gave him. And he created quite a brilliant design from it. And I mean, it's so funny because I have the mold of it hanging on my wall in my loft. And so many people have come in and said, oh, that kind of looks like Donald Trump. Like the masculine, you know, large, you know, mm-hmm. and obviously he really added this masculine Friday the 13th, Michael Myers kind of element to it that, you know, really, I think it just goes to show, you know, you bring, when minds come together, you create a team, ideas, you know, come out of that you would never thought of alone. And so I was just so ecstatic when I saw the first mask. It was just like, holy shit, this is insane. So yeah, we hope that, you know, we also wanted to create a mask that people would want to wear. So, you know, when the movie comes out, like we're definitely going to try to get people to buy it and, you know, try to sell it and see what we can do to, you know, because the mask can also be used to help sell the movie, the brand of the film, much like Ghostface did for Scream and, you know, Michael Myers did for Halloween. And
the Hulking mask for Friday the 13th.
Yeah,
for sure. I was going to ask you as well, like there has been not a major resurgence in slasher movies, but there has certainly been a resurgence in slasher movies the last couple of years. I was wondering what you thought that was down to, whether it was just the generation that grew up on the 90s slashers is now growing up, or if, you know, these cycles just kind of come around, or what your thought was.
Yeah, I believe that I'm going to write a book one day. One day I'm going to write a book on this. But, you know, horror and slasher became big in the 70s and 80s. And in America, that was the rise of the serial killer. You know, you have Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer. You have these real world monsters that we're hearing about on the news that are lurking, you know, on the streets of our home, of our hometowns. And so I believe that is it, you know, the serial killer culture played up the slasher genre and it continued into the 90s. I personally believe that, you know, I remember very clearly when the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake came out, I thought that was the death of the slasher film. When that movie was released along with The Ring, because now suddenly you could make horror movies, you could put good actors in them and they could be PG-13 or they could be remakes of a brand that people already knew about and made more money. And so the genre changed big time. And you can call Saw a slasher film, but Saw, in my opinion, is not a slasher film. Saw is more of a crime thriller with elements of slasher, similar to Initiation, I'd say. But it's...
I think there is a difference between a slasher film and a serial killer thriller.
Exactly.
Like, you know, like Silence of the Lambs is not a slasher. Seven is not a slasher, you know, but they're based on serial killer.
Exactly. It's like a subgenre of the genre. And so nowadays, I think what you said about the filmmakers who grew up on the 90s are now making the movies themselves, I think that hit the nail on the head. You see that not just with horror, but in any other genre or business. Like, you know, this is totally a little bit of a side branch, but in America, and I'm sure it's growing across the world, drag, like drag queens, that's a huge growing brand. And if you look online, the drag queen fans, the fans of RuPaul's Drag Race and the fans of drag around the world are horror fans, not just horror fans, slasher fans. And a huge part of the LGBTQI community is part of that. But the truth is the drag, if you watch the drag business is new. It's not like it's been around since the 70s. Like drag hit mainstream recently, and you see these kids who grew up watching a show like RuPaul's Drag Race 7 years later become stars on the show and bring their element of drag that they, you know, learned from growing up watching it. And it's the same thing with horror. You're going to see a lot of these younger filmmakers who grew up watching Scream, Urban Legend, try to recreate their own version of that. And, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery, in my opinion. But I do think that the the slasher genre has yet to make a full comeback, but I believe that's going to change in the next few years, especially with the new Scream franchise being revitalized by Paramount. Spyglass, they just wrapped production on Scream 5. And I think that Scream was a genre changing movie. When Scream, it's like, you know, in the horror movies, you're going to have these gems that then suddenly all these copycat movies come out afterwards. And some of those copycat movies are going to have elements of, you know, the movie that they're copying, but also previous horror films. And it's just this beautiful melody of horror. And I believe that the slasher genre, it's going to be difficult for it to revitalize, because we also live in a day and age to where people don't necessarily celebrate some of the tropes of the slasher genre anymore. You could say that they're not PC, much like the misogyny, the inherent misogyny of just watching a girl screaming and getting sliced up. You know, people view that differently now than before. And to, you know, bring it back to the serial killer generation, you know, serial killers, I mean, they're obviously still around, but they're not as many of them, just purely because of, you know, DNA and science. You know, they get caught sooner. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. And so I think that you're going to see that genre steer towards society and culture and how we live. You know, back in the 70s, a man could walk around with a mask and go kill somebody and not get caught as easily as he could today. So how can you elevate the reality of the horror that people watch slasher for? People watch slasher to be put in that position of like, what would I do? Would I turn the lights on? Would I go down that hall? Like, what would I say? What would I do? It's a ride. It's a fun, thrilling ride, because you know, when the movie is over, you're not going to be dead. You're going to, you know, be alive and the movie's over. And so how can you give an audience for today's audience, how can you give them that same ride that, you know, was a fun thrill like you had back in the 90s, but with a slightly more elevated story and issues and cultural norms that we're used to today.
Yeah. Well, I was actually going to ask you about that, because I've noticed that obviously a lot of the slashers that came out in the 80s, particularly ones that came, you know, obviously Halloween's a classic and there is some classics, but there's plenty of films that came out in the 80s that were like kind of on the back of Friday the 13th and just kind of had that formula, the formula that Scream mocked, you know, that thing of the girl runs up the stairs and all that kind of stuff. And it was these kind of trashy fun films that were really mainly about the kills and the inventiveness of the kills. And then in the 90s, it became about the Scream thing, and it became about meta, and it became about the references and poking fun at all the rules of the game. And so now what I've noticed is there does seem to be this kind of this revitalization of the slasher, and some of them are doing things that are unusual because they're doing things like more straight face. For example, a film like Terrifier is just like a kind of straight 80s slasher done in a very straight style. But I've also noticed a kind of mini trend of slashers that are kind of issue driven. I've recently interviewed the director Nicholas Payne Santos, who did a slasher called It Cuts Deep, and it revolves around toxic masculinity. I also interviewed Jill Gevorgezian about her film The Stylist, and it's a female slasher, and that's around the issues of social isolation and anxiety. And even something like a bigger film that came out just recently, Freaky, is, you know, a kind of daft film in many ways, body swapping, comedy slasher horror, but also it is something that deals with gender issues. And it does, there does seem to be, and obviously your movie as well, and this does seem to be a kind of mini trend that's happening. Do you think this is going to be turn into the kind of third wave of a slasher, this kind of more social conscious slasher, if you will?
I am going to look into my crystal ball. I think so. I really do. And the reason I do is because the younger generation isn't interested in watching we can watch those movies again, you know, and you're going to obviously have the sentiment of those movies from the 80s and the 90s, you know, and you're going to have people that like Stranger Things, you know, you're going to have people that just do it purely for the sentiment of creating a great story, and they create great characters, and that's that. There doesn't need to be a social issue involved with it. But I do believe that there is going to continue to be a generation of storytellers who are interested in doing that and taking these social issues and turning them into stories that we want to celebrate within the genre. And the resurgence of the slasher genre, as you called it, the resurgence is only going to give a platform for those voices. And I think it was the entrepreneur Mark Cuban. I mean, the movie business, it's for money. It's to make money. You know, there are obviously artists like myself, you know, we do it for the art, but you know, there comes a point where you got to make money. And I believe, especially here in America, Mark Cuban said it. He said that the future of capitalism is social enterprise. And that's another quote that I just think about a lot, because it's like, if you're going to get any sort of product out to the world, whether it's a movie or whether it's a home care product, whatever it is, you got to have some kind of social issue attached to it to get it to the younger, you know, the younger audiences nowadays, because that's something that they really steer towards, is changing the world. And I think that you're going to see a younger generation of filmmakers that choose to use their art for that, for sure.
Do you think that I was also wondering as well, if you thought there was, let me see how to word it, like if you know, like a kind of controversy around that, like, because I was just thinking, like, the slasher subgenre in terms of horror, I think has probably the most schizophrenic audience. You mentioned that there is a big segment of the slasher audience that's like from drag and from the LGBTQA, you know, community and stuff like that. But then also it also has a large section of kind of a dude bro-ish audience as well. It's a very schizophrenic subgenre.
It is. And you, if you're going to make, and that I totally agree with you. And if you're going to make a horror movie, you can't just make a movie for the elite left liberals. You can't just make a movie for, you know, the alt-right, you know, dude bros, you know, like obviously America is a very divided country right now. And so you're going to see that division in the art and the movies that come out. And so my personal belief is that you can make a movie that satisfies both. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do with Initiation. And I think that, you know, you can make a feminist horror film and have it not, oh, and you know, that's what you, that's something that I learned taking that Making Media for Social Change class at USC, is how can you reach that larger audience, you know, not just by being, this is a social issue film, or, you know, this is a high concept elevated horror movie, but, you know, this is a movie that's you're going to get your blood and guts, you know, that you came for. You got to give everybody what they came to the theater for. And I believe that you can do both. Absolutely. Like the dude bros, you know, are gonna, you know, they're not just going to watch the movie to see a naked chick, you know, running around, you know, screaming, you know, they're gonna do it for the blood and guts too. And I also just believe something in the psychology of you know, a dude bro watching another dude bro get murdered. You know, you'd be surprised how many people actually probably think to themselves, hey, I never saw that before. You know, I've never seen a guy, you know, get murdered right after he's jerking off. Like it's new, and it's something that exactly, it's like that's a dude bro, that's something that dude bros would laugh at, but yet is inherently feminine. You know, if you could write a all about how it's feminist. You know, it's like it's like a double-edged knife.
That is true. And you never know. It might, you know, like over the course of the film, it might get people to reflect. And, you know, it's always, you know, you're more likely to get people to reflect by just in engaging on those terms rather than browbeating. So like to making it accessible to all in that way is the best way to go about things. From my perspective,
I think that it will always come down to the characters and if the characters are relatable to the audience.
Yeah.
You've got to have characters that the audience can put themselves in the shoes of and say to themselves, what would I do in that situation? That's why we watch movies. If you have some, you know, especially today's audience, you know, they're used to watching a 3-minute YouTube video. What makes you think they're going to have the attention span to sit down and watch an hour and a half long film? That's hard to do. Even, you know, I'm in my 30s and it's hard for me to sit down and watch a movie because it's an emotional investment, you know, emotional and intellectual investment. For me, it is anyway. And I think that if you're able to, you know, to make a movie for that younger generation, you know, that can be celebrated for what it stands for, then you can make a movie that has the ability to be seen by a lot of people.
Absolutely. So I was going to kind of move on to the release of the film, and we were talking a little bit before we started recording about your festival run. I want to talk a little bit about that. You made it to a couple of festivals, Screamfest and Stitches, but your festival run was somewhat curtailed by the current shit show that is the world.
Yes, it has been. I guarantee you one of the reasons our investors gave us money to make this movie is because we're like, we can get this in South by Southwest. You know, we didn't know that we could get into South by, we had no clue, but we knew that Brian had been to South by Southwest for a couple of projects. I had a project there a few years ago. Brian had done a really great job, you know, really building a relationship with the festival. And, you know, we made the movie thinking this is a South by Southwest film. And when we got in, we shot the movie May of 2019 and March of 2020, we were ready to premiere it. That's less than a year. And that was hard. But I think one of the reasons we were able to make that happen and everything aligned perfectly is because of our goal of South by Southwest. Now, of course, a week before the festival, it got canceled. And, you know, that day's kind of a blur. I had to turn my phone off, got so many calls being, you know, cast and crew. It was a hard day. But luckily, we had already signed on with our sales agents. And that's one of the things that I learned is very important when going into the festival circuit is you really need an agent, much like an actor needs an agent, a movie needs an agent. And we had gotten XYZ's attention once we got in. Like when you get into South by Southwest, you catch people's attention. And we caught XYZ Films' attention. And XYZ Films is their, I mean, what a freaking powerhouse pedigree of a brand to say that they like your movie. Like that was just insane. Like just going to XYZ Films and then CAA. So already part of the team. And I think because we had them selling the movie, I felt like we were in good hands when South by got canceled. And we were, you know, because obviously there were so many movies that didn't get seen or bought or anything after South by Southwest. And a lot of filmmakers were put in, you know, stuck between a rock and a hard place. We were very fortunate that we had XYZ and CAA. And because of that, we were able to get the movie seen, you know, and sold before, because nobody knew it was going to happen, you know, when the pandemic hit and all the shutdowns happened. Nobody knew. It was all unknown. And so we got the movie seen and we got a couple of offers. And I think that's something that, you know, we're always going to know, or we're never going to know what could have been with the South by, because a festival screening is so important for, you know, the business of independent film, because if your movie's good and it gets good reviews and it has a good showing, like we had like a Saturday night premiere. I mean, it was all going to be perfect, but you know, we're never going to know what that premiere could have been. And I think it's important not to dwell on that, because outcome of our film is what we would have wanted if we had that premiere. We got a distributor who, in my opinion, is the best distributor for this movie. We lucked out, and you know, luckily XYZ Films, you know, they took it to the Cam market over the summer. And you know, I think because we had already been acquired, there was a lot of tiptoeing around what festivals to go to, because like I know that Saban did not want us to play at a festival that was strictly digital, mm-hmm. purely for privacy reasons. And I, you know, fully support that. Last thing you want is a movie with a twist ending and have your twist revealed before the movie comes out. And so I was totally on board for really whatever game plan they had. And Screamfest is a festival that is very near and dear to my heart, because Rachel Bolofsky, the programmer who started Screamfest, she's the one who I met her years ago with my short Dembanger, and Screamfest showed the short Dembanger back in 2013. And that showing really got me a lot of buzz, and I really saw the power of that festival within the horror community. And since then, I'd had a couple of other films at Screamfest. Brian had a movie at Screamfest. And, you know, Rachel said that they were going to, you know, still do a premiere. And this was in the summer. And so we thought, okay, what if we just had a fall premiere to sort of just get the movie out into the ether and get some reviews and get a little bit of buzz going. So then Saban can use that to sell the movie whenever they decide to release it the following year. Because we knew that the movie wasn't going to come out until 2021. And so as opposed to just sit on our thumbs and have everybody forget about the movie, we wanted to try to generate as much as we could with it. And, you know, the drive-in festival premiere was just wonderful for us to have. I would not recommend watching this movie at a drive-in. I'd love, you know, just purely because the social media graphics, it's not easy to read if you're far away, because, you know, we do have a lot of online texting, right, yeah. You know, and that's, you know, that's something that you don't think about, hey, will this movie work for a drive-in? You know, obviously if you're sitting in a theater or watching it on your phone or your TV at home, you're going to be able to read it just fine, but a drive-in is very different. And then Seatgest was just to be part of the Seatgest family was sort of mind blowing that, you know, we got accepted into that festival. That's one thing I am so freaking bummed about, is that I could not go to that festival. That festival is the longest running genre festival, and some of the greatest filmmakers and films have been there. And I just really wish I could have gone to Spain to help celebrate it, but, you know, I couldn't be there. But luckily it did get a screening or two there. And I know that the pandemic shut down the festival before it finished running. But really at this point, you know, I think that the business of film festivals is changing, and it's going to continue to change until this vaccine comes out. You know, we're not going to be seeing huge crowds of festivals for a long time, but yet we're still going to need to watch movies. And so it's kind of riding that wave and exploring this new world of a film release that we're all living in now.
Absolutely. Well,
yeah, it's been a journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And the kind of different, the rise, the re-rising of the drive-in, and all these kind of digital festivals and various ways that we're finding ways to still watch movies. And some of it's been pretty good, because here in the UK, there's been a couple of digital horror film festivals that I wouldn't have been able to attend because they were in London, Manchester, you know, so, but I was able to digitally attend them this year. So that was quite fun.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's good that you're able to see those movies. You know, I definitely wish that we could have been a part of some of them, but, you know, it'll just give us a bigger splash when the movie comes out.
Absolutely. And kind of, so rolling forward, 2021 this year, that, well, it will be 2021 when this episode is still 2020. Behind the scenes of the podcast.
2021 in my mind. Come on, it's 2020, we're over it.
It's 2021. Fuck 2020. So rolling forward, lastly, what are you working on next? According to IMDb, a TV series called Grand. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, Grant is a TV series that I had been developing with Brian and Malson's Media. It's an Indian-based production company. They're one of the investors on our film, and the owner of that company is actually a USC alum. And believe it or not, I connected through him from a student that I TA'd. And Grant is, it's about it's another college-based film, and it's about a college athlete who experiences a severe injury before his, before he starts his freshman year, is where he's supposed to be playing basketball, and he's unable to play. And so we see him navigate the athletics division, and he gets involved in this cryptocurrency scheme, because another huge issue here in America is pay for play with college athletes. And so it really involves sort of how this guy tries to launder money, from the NCAA and these different brands that are just, funneling money into the university and these players to play basketball. And that's a project that's been in development for probably about a year now. We'll see what happens with that one. The two movies that I've really been focused on, I'm working on a crime thriller called Westlake, and it's essentially a modern day Chinatown. But it's involving issues that are very LA-centric, Los Angeles-centric, homelessness, Black Lives Matter, defunding the police, and really sort of bringing a Chinatown type of city corruption element to a noir thriller. And again, bringing elements of horror to that type of movie is, like, I remember you mentioned Sounds of the Lambs earlier. Really, those are the kind of movies that give me life, and writing characters that we haven't seen before, characters that go through, LGBT. I'm very much interested in continuing my career in writing movies about, gay characters. I'm an openly gay man, and I think that it's important to create characters that represent, what it's like to be a gay man, and not necessarily stereotype it. And if you can take that and put it in a Chinatown, make Jack Nicholson a gay Black cop, then I am on board. So that's been, and I'm a huge fan of drag and bringing drag into that. And so Westlake is a movie I've been working on all year, really. It's a movie that it's a tough one. It's a puzzle of a movie to work on. And then I'm also working on another sort of thriller, horror thriller that takes place in the Joshua Tree National Park desert here in California, and involves there's a group here, an alt-right group called the Boogaloo Movement, and sort of bringing in how these real world things that we should be afraid of can really stir the lives of characters. So those are the projects that I'm devoting all of my time and creative energy to right now.
Okay, well, we look forward to checking them out and talking to you on the show again, John. But this time, thank you very much for coming on New Horror Express.
Thank you so much for having me. I, I'm very, very happy you got a chance to see the movie, and I can't wait to see what people think of it, and hopefully this type of dialogue will get them excited for it.
That was my guest John there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And make sure those are 5-star reviews, because according to those wacky algorithms, anything less than that means that we are terrible. I don't know either. Anyway, that is all for this time, but be sure to join me next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!